This is Friday, the 1st of December, 1989, and we're with Steve Hague and I, Jim Pakula, are with Dr. Alan McCrae in his office at Biblical Seminary. And for this particular session, we are going to backtrack and cover the time that Dr. McCrae spent with William Foxwell Albright. Dr. McCrae,
yes.
You would like to describe your first meeting of Dr. Albright, and from there on.
Good. I think for discussion of that, I should step back a little, even though the introduction to it I have already given on a previous time. This was that one day I had gone to Europe to study for 2 years in Germany and then planning to spend a year in Palestine. And during my first year in Germany, I preached during the second semester every second Sunday at the American church there. And one day, I looked down at the congregation and saw among them Dr. Melvin Grove Kyle, who was then president of Xenia Theological Seminary, which was at that time a very evangelical seminary. And I'd been reading his articles on his archaeological work in Palestine for years. And I took him out to dinner after the church and talked with him, and in the course of discussion he found out about my plan, and he said, "Oh, don't wait till year after next." He says, "Next year will be Dr. Albright's last year." And he says, "Dr. Albright has been there for 9 years. He knows Palestine as nobody else does. And he is as fine in his understanding of archaeology as anybody in the world, and you ought to go there when he's there to work with." Well, I decided the best thing to do was the next year to take off 2 months in addition to the 2 months vacation at the university, and that way to have 3 months in Jerusalem. So I went, and when I got to Jerusalem, I met Dr. Albright, a very quiet-spoken man, a man with a good sense of humor, very friendly, and a man from San Francisco Seminary who had been studying in Berlin when I had been, was now in Palestine there, and sort of introduced me to Albright. Well, I stayed at the American School of Oriental Research, of which he was director. It was a nice building, just outside, not far, maybe 5 or 10 minutes walk from the old city of Jerusalem. And in it they had a nice classroom and quite a number of guest rooms. And I stayed there for most of these 3 months. Dr. Albright conducted a number of trips around Jerusalem and explained things to us. I remember very well his taking us to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and to the Garden Tomb. And he said, "The Church of the Holy Sepulchre," he said, "all the evidence we have points to its having been the place where Christ was buried. But," he says, "it may not be." Then he says, "there's the Garden Tomb." He says, "all the evidence we have is against it being the place where he was buried, but it may be." Well, that shows how, I think Dr. Albright once spoke about that people being so interested in details about Jerusalem, where he says everything has been in confusion and turmoil and destroyed so many times that most is very uncertain. Whereas he says they spend their time here instead of going up to Galilee, where there's so much that's absolutely certain that's of importance in biblical history. Well, the way he spoke there, I thought was very interesting about that. Albright was one of the pioneers of the use of pottery for dating purposes. That was one thing that had thrilled me when I'd begun to read about Palestinian archaeology. The way that the Flinders Petrie in 1890 was the one who had either discovered or brought to the attention of the world the importance of pottery for dating. These are cheap clay dishes which would be used and then thrown away. They were not considered of any great importance. But for that very reason, they are of tremendous importance for dating. He says coins are very helpful, but a coin can be misleading. It can have been dropped down to another section or in some way gotten out of the right environment to date something. But he said that there's so much clay. He said they are dishes which everybody had. They were necessary for life. They were easily broken. When broken, they were so cheap it wasn't worth trying to mend them, make new ones. And over the course of the years, the styles kept constantly changing. And so they are the most useful tool for dating the places or the things, the levels where they are found. Now, of course, Dr. Albright used to go to mounds around Palestine, and we would look around and we would pick up pieces of pottery. He would look at a little piece of a handle. He'd say, that I think comes from such and such a century. And then we would find a piece of a vase. He would tell what century it came from. And often, just in looking at the pottery on the top of these various mounds, you would be able to tell how long the place had been occupied and by what at what periods. However, this data became very confused. And I fear Albright himself, or at least his influence, may have had a big part to do in confusing it, because his students, of whom I was one, would pick up interesting pieces of pottery and put them in our pockets. And then we'd be in the next mound where we were examining the pottery, and we would see some we wanted to keep, and we'd empty our pockets and put the new ones in. So it got carried about from mound to mound that way. Well, of course, that doesn't affect the importance of the pottery you dig up out of the ground, but it does mean that the top, which used to be such a useful tool, is not nearly so useful as it was.
Did you actually do any excavating, or was
no.
this mainly visiting sites?
We visited all the sites where excavation was being held then.
Was any in progress right then?
Oh, yes. I'll tell you about Professor Boddy. You'd be much interested in that, I think.
And who was with you besides you and Albright? In other words, Germans and...
Later in the time we were there, we went on a horseback trip through the back country, up along the coast, and then across and back down through Transjordan. And there were four of us in the party. We've been born in four different continents. Dr. Albright was the son of a Methodist missionary in South America. So he was born in South America, and of course I in North America. Professor Yerko was born in Germany, and Dr. Lee, who was educated in the United States, was born in China and was professor in Yenching University in Beijing, China.
Did you camp on this trip?
We camped on that trip, yes.
Was there safety, or were there still marauding bands at that time?
We would go to a town out in the country. We might find a little Arab town, and we would go to it, and Dr. Albright would speak to the chief of the town, and they would we would hire somebody from the town to stand or sit in front of our tent through the night. And that would protect us from pilferers. But as Dr. Albright said, if you go to an Arab town, you were under the protection of that town. And there was nothing to fear except, of course, pilferers or small fields, that sort of thing. But if you park out in the countryside, you then were under nobody's protection. He said that there had this, Palestine was then under British mandate. He said that there was a man and his wife who had walked across much of Europe and down from Spain to Africa and all across North Africa. I think this is the year before. And then had crossed up into Palestine. And there they had they'd been camping along the way, carrying their stuff. And they camped with their little tent out in about 3 miles from one village and 3.5 from another village. So they were fair game. They were not under anybody's protection. And he said during the night they were attacked and all killed and everything was stolen. But the British investigated and hanged the people who were involved in it. So there was pretty good safety then, maybe more than later on after the division came. But we had nothing to fear. We were under the direction, under the protection of the Talmud. And we would, it was interesting on that trip to see the conflict of civilizations. We would come to a little Jewish colony, and there would be the girls with the short skirts, women with the short skirts and with the painted faces, and you'd think you were up in New York City somewhere. And you had they all talking Hebrew, of course. Then you would come to an Arab town, and if you came in the morning, the men would all be asleep, and the women would be out working, and they would be afraid of their lives to speak to strangers of what their husbands might do if they found them talking to strangers. So they try to get rid of you as quickly as possible, so they might give you false directions to get rid of you. Whereas if you'd come to the Arab town in the afternoon, then the men would be sitting around telling stories, and they were tickled to see some visitors coming through and chat with you, and they would even appoint one of their number to go with you and guide you to the place where you wanted to go. That was a very, very interesting 3 weeks that we had on that trip. Of course, we had Arab muleteers who we carried all our luggage on muleback, and we rode horses. Albright was a wonderful horseman. I don't know why he gave me the best horse to ride, but I rode this fine stallion. It was hard to hold him back to stay with the rest of the party. When he started to go uphill, he would just tear up the hill. But if we saw another horse coming, which rarely happened because there were hardly any horses in Palestine at that time, but if you saw a horse coming, I would stop and trade horses with Albright because he was riding an old plug that was perfectly safe and I was not an experienced horseman. But Dr. Albright, I saw him one time when a policeman came riding on a horse out in the open country, and the horse I'd been riding went right up on his hind legs and pawed the air and was going to fight with that other horse. Dr. Albright was able to handle him. He was a good horseman. I had no claim to be a good horseman. I don't know why he gave me the best horse, but it certainly was pleasant. When we would come to a town, or we'd come to an archaeological place or anything like that, Dr. Albright would tell us, he'd been there for 9 years, and he would tell us all about the place and the history and what was known of the archaeology and so on. But he always had to tell it twice, because Professor Yerku didn't understand spoken English, and Professor Lee didn't understand spoken German. So I would hear him tell twice. And naturally, there'd be some things he'd tell he didn't tell the other time. And, of course, having it repeated, you'd remember it better anyway. So I had a real advantage over the other two in the party. But it was a very interesting trip with them for 3 weeks. That's getting along a ways. Albright also was holding classes there. I don't remember how often we met at the, this was toward the end of my time that we had this trip, but I don't remember how often we had these classes, but he would assign you subjects and you would study up on in the library of the American school there, and then we would meet, there'd be four or five of us there, and we would meet with him and discuss these subjects, generally subjects which were right on the edge of increasing knowledge, and so there would be comparatively little known with certainty, but it was very interesting to get the insights that he had. I sprained my ankle while I was there, and for a few days I was tied up in the room, I couldn't get out, and it was cold January, wet outside quite a bit then, and I had they used little kerosene stoves, and the stove always gave you good heat as long as you kept watching it. But if you looked the other way, immediately it would start putting out smoke and soot and dirty up everything. And of course you'd have to run and turn it off and get somebody to fix it up then. But the minute you look away, that was bound to happen. I had some lessons from a rabbi there in spoken Hebrew. And after I sprained my ankle, the next time I was due to go to his house for a lesson, and my ankle had been healing 3 or 4 days, so I thought that by now I ought to be able to make it. So I took my cane and I started out, and when I got halfway there, my foot leg felt so bad I just sat down by the side of the road, and a carriage came by, one of the horse taxis that they had, and he stopped and I got in, and he took me to the home of this rabbi, and the rabbi turned to his friend who was there. He says he risked his life for Hebrew. He was so proud of it. But after that, he came to the school and gave me the few remaining lessons that I had from that. Albright was a very fine linguist, and he would talk in their native language with almost anybody that he met along the way. He was also, Albright, one of his great achievements was to get the various groups to talking together, because all the various groups there were jealous of each other and very much afraid that the others would have an advantage over them. And but Albright got started a Palestine Oriental Society, which would, they had a meeting just very soon after I got there at the American school. And they had papers given in English, French, and German, other languages on the recent developments and recent discoveries. And Albright was on good terms with all the different people, and he would get it. They all knew, he told me, he says, they know that I will not publish anything about what they're doing until they've published it first. And so he says, they trust me. But they wouldn't trust each other. He took me to the, he took our group to McGiddle, where they were excavating Solomon's stables. And he told how the assistant director of the University of Chicago was excavating at McGiddle. And the assistant director of the expedition would come around hide just around the corner while the director was showing Albright everything. And they didn't have tape recorders yet then, but the assistant director would sneak around the side of the building and take pictures to show how the director was showing everything to Albright and telling him about everything. And the director had sent a wire to Chicago and said, if Dr. Albright is forbidden access to the excavation, you can have my resignation effective immediately. So in that case, they got rid of the assistant director, and Albright would Albright never would play unfair with any of these people, but he would. He had the knowledge that he got from each of them, and which would enable him to make good suggestions to others. And he was sort of a melding force to bring them together. Albright told me how he had they had many visitors. People would come and stay at the American schools. And he said that there was a famous excavator was coming, and a very outstanding student of ancient languages. And he was looking forward to meeting these two men, and he was thinking how happy they would be to exchange information and to meet together. And, of course, they came from different countries, different backgrounds. He said that when they got there, he introduced them. He introduced one, and he says how this was the man who had excavated so-and-so, and the other fellow, who was a language man, said, "Oh, a digger." And then he told him about the other man. He says, "Oh, a language man." So the people, some are good at one and not good at the other. And most people are in one area or the other. But Albright was expert in both. And he was able thus to bring knowledge from both areas and put it together. There's one feature about Albright that was rather unfortunate in a way, and yet it was fortunate in a way. Other excavators and scholars mostly want to wait till they're absolutely sure they're correct. And the result is that the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are many of them that have not yet been published at all. And the rest of the scholarly world wants to know what's in these scrolls, and there's no way they can find out, because they have been parceled out among the various scholars all over the world for study and publication. And each of these men wants to have his publication have an absolutely correct interpretation of all the difficult and fine points connected with it. So often they'll take 20 or 30 years working on the thing before they get any publication, and no one else is allowed to say a word publicly about it until the man to whom it's been given for publication publishes it. That is now a tremendous hindrance in the study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, at that time it was equally in many others. Features. But Albright he told me about a man who came to New York and was welcomed. He claimed to be a great expert in Egyptian and in Mesopotamian things. And he was welcomed by the mayor of New York and given tremendous praise as a great scholar. And Albright said, when he talks in one of these committee of these society meetings, he said he tells about something and the Egyptologists think he's talking about Mesopotamia and the Mesopotamian scholars think he's talking about Egypt. So they think he's a great scholar, but he says, "I know both fields, so I see it's all humbug." And the man disappeared within the next 10 years, but he'd been rather famous right at that particular time. We had, this was an unfortunate time, year in a way, because there were some people there from an American theological seminary who, their wife, I think, got into a misunderstanding, or worse, with Mrs. Albright. And he wrote a letter to the president of the American schools, sharp, criticizing Albright. I didn't hear about that till I read about it in Albright's biography. But when we were there, you could see the feeling that there was between these people. I met one young fellow at the school who it was quite interesting. He was a young Jew who wanted, instead of going to college, to go around the world and visit all the museums and study them. And he spent maybe a month or 6 weeks there in Jerusalem. And then he went down to Egypt and studied a while. And he was traveling around the world, spending 2 years visiting museums. And he paid little attention to the daughter of this professor from San Francisco Seminary. And the man didn't like it at all. He he didn't want him talking to his daughter. Eventually, they moved out of the American school and went to the American colony to stay. Judging from the biography of Albright, this was the only year he had any trouble at that time. So I just happened to be there that year when he had this trouble. He was had a most fertile mind, very interesting. So one trouble I started to say about his writing is this. The other scholars, most of them, don't want to publish anything until it's absolutely correct. And so they go very, very slow. Some of them spend the whole life before they publish anything. But Albright, the minute he'd find something new or the minute he'd get a new bright idea, he'd write an article. And then maybe 2 months later he found it was wrong. So he'd write another article to show off what he said that was wrong, and take advantage of comments other people had made, and you sometimes find him on a matter publishing a certain view, and then 2 months later reversing it, and then 2 months after that going to a third view, and then 2 months after that he may find his original was, after all, really the correct view. But it means that it's pretty hard from his ephemeral material to take an article and say, this is what Albright thought. Of course, in his books, I don't think that would be true at all. His first book, which he wrote, he offered it to, I guess, a dozen publishers, and they all turned it down. He wrote in a rather stilted style. I remember when reading one of them, he said, we must remember that in the that Crete held the thalassocracy of the eastern Mediterranean in the second millennium B.C. Well, if you know Greek, of course, you know right away that means that Crete ruled the seas. But if you don't know Greek, thalassocracy is not an English word. And sometimes his writings that way, because of their scholarliness, would be difficult for the average person. Excuse me, 1 second.
Sir,
I was telling about Albright's, I want to say a bit about his youth. He was the son of a Methodist missionary, was brought up in Chile. And then he went to Johns Hopkins and studied under the name I had in mind a second ago, Professor, he's the man who got out the Bible with the different documents in different colors, Paul Haupt. Albright studied with Paul Haupt and took his PhD there. And Haupt was, Albright said, that Haupt was the most radical man from a viewpoint of biblical study in America at the time. Well, as I figure, Albright accepted most of what Haupt taught and came out there following Haupt's ideas pretty much. Then he got into excavating and into study there, and he kept finding things that proved something in the Bible was correct. And when he did, it seemed to me it was as if somebody were to say, well, my father wasn't such a fool after all. And he was happy about it. He would yell to the sky, to everybody, isn't this wonderful how this fits with the Bible, how this proves the Bible's accuracy. Well, of course, he took as his prima facie view a point, not, here's the Bible, this is God's truth, and then we see how things fit in with it. He took Paul Haupt's interpretations, that's the prima facie. So as he found evidence, he changed it to fit with biblical interpretation. And he did not change, I think, where he hadn't found evidence. So that his view was a sort of a mixture. He was a very devout man, though. Where was it he wrote, or is it said in there? He said that his wife was a Roman Catholic. She was converted to Roman Catholicism in Jerusalem.
And he said that his wife brought into the house all the latest Roman Catholic books and literature. And he said he read them all. And he said his minister, he attended the Methodist Church, and his minister was a neo-Orthodox. And he brought to him all the latest books from that viewpoint, and he read them all. And he said that his position would be sort of in between the two. And but as Albright said, he excavated for a number of years with Melvindrell Kyle, and Kyle was very conservative. At that time, we considered the United Presbyterians to be the really Orthodox people. We didn't realize how the modernism had been burrowing into the denomination. But my mind.
Talking about the religious life of Albright? Or his
views? Yeah. He said that with Kyle, he said that he made Kyle more liberal and Kyle made him more conservative, he said. In other words, as they talked, they each moved toward the other. Kyle was archaeological editor of the Sunday School Times, and he had many articles on archaeology in the Sunday School Times. Some very good ones, too. But that was when I was at the University of Chicago one summer. Albright's first book came out, and shortly after that, they had what they called the Near East Club, which would meet and discuss literature. And one fellow there said to me, he says, "I've been asked to review this book of Albright's." And he says, "Oh," he says, "why should I spend time on it?" He says, "on a book by a conservative like that," he says. He felt, you know, they were so disrespectful to Albright there because he was so conservative. But when the director went away for 3 months, he got Albright to come in. This after he had retired, to come in and take over his position for 3 months. So among scholars, he was highly regarded right to the very end of his life.
I know he got over 25 honorary doctorates, including one from Harvard.
Oh, yes.
Over the years.
He was recognized, universally recognized. Yes.
Well, your time with him must have been very memorable. Did you have any devotional times on that horseback trip?
Yes.
Or at the Institute?
Sunday night.
What were they like?
Well, Sunday night, Dr. Albright said, now he says, we will have a... in the tent, he says, we will have a service tonight, and would you arrange the service? So
the four of you would have a service.
Four of us would have the service. And, of course, two of them couldn't understand German. One couldn't understand English. So it was sort of an interesting problem to arrange a service that would have some meaning to all.
Did you preach?
No.
What did you do for the service?
I forget the details.
Did he have a part?
Oh, yes. He was a very devout man. Very devout. He faithfully attended the Methodist Church right to the end of his life. Hmm.
That doesn't seem to be brought... Maybe it is in this biography.
I think she's a Jew. She's Jewish, isn't she? The woman that... His secretary that wrote that.
Leona Running and David Friedman are the two, co-authors.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, I just read in here that he blamed himself for his wife's conversion to Catholicism.
Really?
Partly because he said he was too busy to attend to her theological views.
Oh, did he say that?
Huh.
That's interesting.
Incredible.
Very distressed about it at first.
Oh, really?
And then he, of course, accepted it later. Like you said, he was reading the book.
Oh, I see. I didn't. I hadn't read that part. Yeah. Yes. Well, when Albright wrote his first book, he sent it to numerous publishers, I understand, and they all turned it down. And of course, the style has quite a bit of worded language in it. You know, it's not the easiest spot to read. But his wife paid for the publication. And she paid the expenses of the book. And then he asked the Johns Hopkins Press to put their name on the book and take care of the distribution, which they did. But after that book, all the publishers were after him for another book. Because, of course, while the publishers didn't know Albright, the scholarly world knew him. And his book, the book was very widely sold. First, and then his other books, of course, there's no difficulty in getting published.
You first met him then. Do you remember when you first met him in the Holy Land? Was it at the American Institute?
At the Institute.
And you stayed in a room there?
I stayed in a room there for about 3 months.
Yeah.
And we had these meetings together there in these classes, and then he took us on day trips, and we went horseback for 3 weeks. So I had a lot of contact with him there, and then I was out in Wheaton a few years later, and they had him there to give a lecture, and I had just happened to be there, and he greeted me like an old friend, of course, and so in between we were had a lot of time together. And then at the University of Chicago, I was there during the time when he was in charge of taking the place of the director for 3 months. So I had a little contact with him in subsequent years.
When was the last time you had contact with him? Do you recall? Or
no, I don't. I don't. I went to Baltimore to hear him speak on the Dead Sea Scrolls shortly after they were discovered.
And
it was interesting. I came back here and started teaching in Philadelphia, and then I immediately went down to Baltimore to see about taking work with him. And I took a streetcar out to the area of Johns Hopkins University, and as I stepped off the car, there was Mrs. Albright on the corner. And so she took me home to have lunch with her and Dr. Albright. And I talked with him about taking graduate work there with him. And he said, I'd be glad to have you as a student. But he said, you ought to look into what's available in Philadelphia, because they have much more available there than we have here in Baltimore. And he said, between the University of Pennsylvania and the Dropsy College, they've got a great deal there. Well, the big thing that kept me from going to work with Albright was that the expense of going down there every week would be pretty high, and there was no commuter ticket. You could get a commuter a distance from either city, but you couldn't get one for the whole trip, and it would have been a lot of time. And then I looked into what was here, and of course here they had, there I had just Albright. Here I had a lot of men that were outstanding in their area. So I stayed here, and then about 20 years later, I guess, Albright was to give a lecture at the Dropsy College, and my wife and I went. And when we got there, we found that he had fallen. This was not long before his death. He had fallen and would be unable to get there. So they had a man from New York pinch hit to the lecture, give a lecture instead. And when I got home, I wrote to him and told him how disappointed I was not to hurt him. And I said, I wish that I had carried through my original idea and come to work with you. And he wrote back and said, you were very wise to do what you did. He said, you had some very fine scholars to study with there in Philadelphia. And he says, for many years while I was teaching at Johns Hopkins, I had only very poor students. It was only after my book was published that the Oriental Seminary became an exciting experience. I think after that he had outstanding students from all over the country. And they formed Some of them, like Wright, used to speak of the Albright School, and he was an Albright man. So, and they, we had a very fine fellow who graduated from Faith who went and studied with him and was completely taken over by him, took up his views and gave up his strong stand he had before. He went and taught at Wheaton for a while, and then he moved to another school in the Chicago area, and then he died. But he transferred his whole affection to Albright.
He must have been a rather, obviously a powerful mentor.
Oh, you are such a very able man.
Would you like to comment any more about his interactions with, say, some of your faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, or comment about some of those faculty members?
Oh, yes. Well, at the University of Pennsylvania, I took work at first with Professor Montgomery, who wrote in the International Critical Series the commentary on Kings and the one on
Daniel.
And Daniel, yes. He wrote Daniel first, and then later Kings. And Montgomery had a great deal of sympathy with conservatives. And he said to me, he says, so much of this liberal teaching or this radical teaching is just hot air. He says, they just bring out any kind of a wild theory. But he was a very, very careful man. Of course, he was, most of the men in those areas are affected greatly by the liberal teachings, of course. And his book on Daniel, he's from the viewpoint of it being written in the Maccabean period, but he says in it that liberals must not arrogate to themselves the whole think they can arrogate to themselves the whole field, because there are some very fine scholars who are holding this strong conservative view of Daniel. He said that in the book. He was always very gracious with me. And he told me, he says, a lot of these radicals, he says, it's just hot air. They're just anything that's radical. He was very gracious, very careful scholar, but extremely considered. I attended his study of various biblical books for a while, but then, I had some fine courses from him, but there was then a class in Kings, and he let most anybody in that asked him to put him in, to let him take the course, and there was a man who he called on to read the first verse of 1 Kings, and he said, now, David was old and he got no heat. Well, you know how much Hebrew that man has studied that translates that way. Very evidently, he just followed the King James Version. So after that, I dropped out. But before that, I had some very good courses from him. He was a very considerate man, and if he just hadn't been subjected, like Albright was, to this liberal teaching, they both were among the more gentlemanly and kindly disposed of the liberal scholars.
And they were on good terms, Montgomery and Albright themselves, and...
Well, I would imagine so. Montgomery was on good terms with everybody. He was a very gracious fellow. But
and active in his own right with the SBL and such.
Oh, yes. He was president of the American Schools, too. When I went to Germany to get books for our seminary library, he gave me a letter addressed to the heads of academies and universities of Europe on their stationery, asking them to give me every courtesy. Which I never used the letter, but it was nice to have. There might have been an occasion when it would have been. I've been really useful. Yes. And then, of course, when I got to University of Pennsylvania, I found that there was the course I wanted then was taught by, or one of the courses I wanted. Oh, and that was, by the way, that was very convenient. I taught at Westminster, and my classes were all in the afternoon. It was the old Princeton tradition that Hebrew had to be 4 to 6 in the afternoon. So, of course, they couldn't have any other class. So my classes were all in the afternoon. I could step out of the building and either there or within a block get a streetcar that would take me right to the university in about 7 minutes. And so I took a heavy program at the university during the next many years. And I didn't bother about trying to fill it up for a degree. I just took what I was interested in. When I got the PhD, Spicer says, you should have had this 6 years ago. But of course, I had just written a thesis then.
Why did you go together with Gelb, and who was the other co-author of that work?
Purvis. Yeah.
How did that relationship develop, and why?
Because we, but first I should say a little about Spicer.
Yeah.
Spicer was he was always very gracious to me. I attended courses with him for 20 or 30 years, at least 20, maybe 30, I forget. He was always very gracious and brilliant, a very brilliant man. He was only, I think, 2 or 3 weeks older than I was. He was always very gracious to me. I attended courses with him for 20 or 30 years, at least 20, maybe 30, I forget. He was always very gracious and brilliant, a very brilliant man. He was only, I think, 2 or 3 weeks older than I was. Had been brought up in, where was it, in Europe? At the end of the First World War, where he lived was in...
He had come over from Europe to be the companion?
No, I think his family came over. I don't know. But during this summer, when he was a young fellow, he worked at this... he was companion to this young man during the summer. And they said that when he went, he could hardly speak English. He didn't have any money. And his health was bad. And in the summer, he gained pretty good health, and he learned English well, and he had considerable money on his trip.
After being with this wealthy Jewish family?
Yes. This young fellow who he was companion to for the summer. Anyway, he was, he had a fairly good number in his classes right along. He was a very interesting teacher. Albrecht became famous. Then Albrecht began recommending his students to study under Spicer. Spicer told me one time, he said, he had 3 or 4 fellowships that he could assign to people. And he said, I had to turn down a man whose standing was A minus. And he said, because everybody was only A's. To fill up all the scholarships that I had. But Spicer was a very interesting chap, a very, very able fellow. And Albrecht used to recommend people to study with Spicer. But what you were, oh yes, Dr. Spicer recommended that we take these Nuzi documents, which he had discovered on an excavation in Mesopotamia. And we read a lot of them in class together there. And then he suggested that a group of us write theses on different areas.
Now, this was Dr. Spicer that recommended this?
Spicer.
So he had done archaeological work at Nuzi?
Yes. He and Chiara from Professor Chiara, who went to the University of Chicago and wrote a most fascinating book called They Wrote on Clay, but then died before I got to the University of Chicago, Chiara did. But Spicer was at that time tremendously interested in Manuzzi tablets, and he suggested that several of us write theses on it. So there was a fellow named Bercus wrote one on the vowels concepts, on the linguistic aspect of the tablets, and someone else wrote on the movable property in the tablets. Someone else on Francis Steele wrote immovable property at Nusi. And Purvis was a student there, graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. He and I wrote on the names. See, there were thousands of names there. And Purvis tried to handle the non-Semitic things, and I took the Semitic things. And then when we wrote our theses and received our degree, Dr. Albright said, I hear that they are getting a book out at the University of Chicago on the proper names of Lucy. And he said, suppose I write them and suggest that we unite the two propositions. So he wrote them, and they agreed to that. And actually, they weren't very far along on the project. We were much further along than they were, but we didn't realize that. And when I got the degree, they made Purvis and me each make a $500 deposit at the university to ensure the publication of our theses. But then Spicer got the Oriental Institute to agree to a joint effort, and they said they would publish it. And so got back most of the 500, not most, but a very large part of it I got back, because I had the contract from them. Well, then Purvis went out there, and he found that actually they had done very, very little. So he sat down there, and Gelb was the other man, the man there who was working on it. So he and Gelb worked on it for a year. And then I visited them one spring, and I spent a while with them, and then I spent a while. I used to go out there and spend a month or two and go out for a Christmas vacation, and we got them ready for publication. So Purvis had found that Gelb was crazy to get credit for everything. Everything under the sun, Gelb had to get credit for. And that was, of course, after all, you don't get much, any great amount of money for being an archaeologist. And you may not get, the thing that most of them are after is recognition. And Albright said to me, he never wrote people to say, after all, that was my, I made that suggestion first. He said, if I did that, he says, I'd be writing all the time. But most of them, they do. They say, you said such a thing, and you didn't recognize that I was the one who had found that. Gelb was determined to get recognition for everything. And so Gelb and Purvis had reached the point where Gelb was supposed to be editor of the volume. When I got there, they had reached the point where Purvis told me, he says, the only way I get along with Gelb is, he says, when he, no matter what he says, I argue against him. So he would argue with Gelb on anything Gelb brought up. So Gelb resigned as editor of the volume. So instead of it being Gelb editor, it was published by written by the three of us, and they got Dr. Allen, who was an Egyptologist on the staff at the University of Chicago, and he was a gracious man, a fine man to work with. And we would sit there, and Purvis would get a section ready. Then he would phone Dr. Allen, was ready, and Allen would come over, and he would give it to him. He would take it off and study it. Then pretty soon we there'd be a call, and Dr. Gelb was asked to come to Dr. Allen's office, and he would talk with him. And they were that way. I made a discussion with quite a lot of the names, and Gelb wrote a summary of it, and he says, we cannot destroy scholarship by saying such a thing as this. Oh, he was frightful the way he talked about a lot of things. And when I first went there, I just said, well, he knows. I won't say it. I won't say anything. I won't say that. Make that theory. But a year later, one time, he came to me and says, you know those names that end like this? He says, I've got an interpretation of it. He says, it's such and such. He started telling me. Oh, I said, Dr. Gill, I made that suggestion on the sheet I gave you last year, and you said it was no good. Oh, did I? He says, never heard of it again. Never heard of it. But when I first went, I would take anything he said. But he wrote a lot of books for the University of Chicago. He had quite a standing, but he was determined to get credit for everything. One time, I went out there at Christmas vacation, and I was given back a section that I had given to Dr. Allen, a section of the book, and there was a part of a page which I had advanced a certain interpretation. And now the lower six or seven lines on the page were devoted to a note by Gelb, in which Gelb said that we cannot wreck, or whatever his word was, Babylonian scholarship by saying such and such, he says, and oh, get the opposite, and he says as Lanceberger says in such and such a magazine, you know. And so when I got that, I went and got the magazine out of the library and the journal, and I read the article by Lanceberger, who many thought was the greatest living scholar of Babylonian material. And I read it carefully. His style was sort of involved style. But as I read it, I said, that fits with what I said, not with what Galva said. So I read it over a couple of times, and then I wrote, I took the page, and I wrote a note on which I said that this view, I said, is further substantiated by the material that is by the statements of Professor Lanceberger in this gave the reference. And I left that for, when I had to come back, I left it for Dr. Allen to see. Next time I saw the sheet, what he had said, Gelb had said a footnote for it, was gone. It was the way I put it, except that there was a footnote. Now Gelb says, as further evidence of this matter, we refer to such and such a tablet. So I see. All I didn't explain. I left it for the editor, and I put a note with it, and I said, Doctor, would you please look at this by statement by Lanceberger in this German book, and see if I've misinterpreted Lanceberger. I said, I wish you would read it and see if you think I have misinterpreted it. Well, he read it and told Gelb he was wrong, so Gelb switched it right over to the view and puts a new note in to show that he has further material substantiating this view, which he had previously said was impossible because of what Lanceberger said. So it just gives you a glimpse of the world of ungodly scholarship, which the only thing to work for, a man in the engineering field can get some big company to give him prestige and money too, but in this field, it's the only thing you can get. Of course, Albrecht got the fame. He deserved it, but he didn't work particularly for it, like Gelb did. Gelb just died last year, I understand.
Was he retired from the University of Chicago?
I don't know.
Or did he move elsewhere? Or? Was he a student there at that point?
Oh no, he was the he was on their regular staff. He was, yeah, he had already published two or three great big volumes of the Orientalist people had published by
now. Now, it's been a while since I've looked at the published form of your dissertation. It appeared that the three parts, or at least your part and Purvis's part particularly, never were, as doctoral students, Gell presumably wasn't doing it as a doctoral dissertation.
No, he was.
Were they ever separate documents? Was your dissertation ever a separate document? Oh. Or was it...
Well, you mean you looked at the big book?
Or yeah.
Or a little at the
author? Well, I think I've seen both, but yeah. I remember the published one, the hardback book.
Yes.
And it was hard to tell that there were actually two dissertations. And
yeah.
It looked like a joint effort. And I was wondering, was there ever a form in which yours and Purvis's were separately issued, or...?
No. Except for, the dissertation came out as a separate publication.
It did.
Oh, yeah. Five of those stack up downstairs.
We may want to be sure to get one of those for the... Do you know whether we have it in the library? I thought we had only the one with Gell, Purvis, and McCrae.
Oh, well, you have the big one, do you?
I believe so.
I had a copy of it sent to the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton University. And
just your own dissertation?
Yeah, no, the whole book.
I see.
I sent to them. See, they gave me a few books.
Oh, Steve can go get one, I guess. Oh, have you been down there? I'd like to go down there sometime. Could I go down there?
Yeah.
And see, and
maybe so
momentarily.
Maybe it's a little late today.
Regarding other faculty at University of Pennsylvania, Montgomery, of course, Spicer, of course.
Well, it was Barton.
Barton?
George Aaron Barton.
Oh, yes.
Am I sick? Yeah.
We probably do have it in the library, but we probably could use an extra copy, I'm sure.
I was quite surprised to see the book, the theological word book of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
That in the introduction to it, Dr. Harris said that for understanding of the nature and character of Hebrew proper names, you should see this book. My statement in this book. I didn't remember I had even dealt with that. But
yeah, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. This footnote on page 286 of your dissertation, published in Philadelphia in 1943, mentioned that one about Dr. Gell.
Yeah.
Is that noted in the theological word book?
Right here. It says that for the principles of name formation in the Hebrew world, one may consult the work of Dr. Alan A. McCrae, the Semitic Names in the Nutsu Tablets, and Nutsu Personal Names, edited by J. Gell.
Edited by Gell, you see?
That's what it says, University of Chicago.
Yeah, well, Gell was one of the three of us, but Dr. Allen was the one.
Huh. I wonder if Gell got on there as editor in the end. I don't recall Alan's name on the published.
Well, it was interesting.
We'll have to check that.
Working with Alan. Dr. Alan, he would take your manuscript, and he would go over it, and he'd make a little red mark, see? And you'd make a statement, see? And if he could save space, save publication, he would cross out three words, and then he would put in one word that would carry the idea. You know, and he was very saving space, but I found that in case after case, I would say something, and he would say, well, no, you don't need that word. And I would say, well, Dr. Allen, I meant so-and-so, and I would explain it to him how I did. Oh, he says, yes, he says, and he would keep the word and add another word to make it clearer. So it actually made it a little longer, but it made it clearer, of course. He was very good at getting exactly your sense. But he would cut out any word that he thought was unnecessary. And he was a good editor. I enjoyed working with him. A gracious man. He was an Egyptologist. So he wasn't trained in our field, but he was a good scholar and had
general knowledge in various.
And Dr. Barton at Pennsylvania.
Oh, yes, Barton, George Aaron Barton. The second or third year that I was teaching, he was professor also at the Episcopal Divinity School, as Montgomery was too. The school has been was closed more 20 or 30 years ago, but then it was quite a famous school, I think. And Freeman, what was his first name? He was one of the group that was closely associated with Westminster in those days. He worked for a doctor a little at the Episcopal Divinity School. And then he came over and took courses with me at Westminster instead, because he had gotten a paper he turned in. Barton wrote, only a dogmatist could write like this. And Barton got a hold of him and told him, he says, you can take courses here if you want, but he says, you could never get your views, you could never get a degree from this school. Well, Barton was he seemed like a nice old fellow, but as Albright said, Montgomery is so exact, so careful, you can trust anything he says. But he says, Barton goes off with wild theories, and he's not near so dependable. Barton wrote the book Archaeology in the Bible, which the American Sunday School Union published, went through many editions. And somebody told me, someone there, Barton had dropped in, and they said to Barton something about, he said he was writing another book, but he says not for publication by the American Sunday School. And one of the disappointments of my life was that when they had a farewell dinner for Barton at the big athletic club on the main square there on the western end of the main part of Philadelphia, camping in the main square, that I saw Montgomery the next day, and he says, I says, well, did you have a good time with me? He says, Barton got up and he reminisced for 2 hours, he says. He says it was an honor, Barton. And you know, Barton, of course, he was Quaker background, and I think conservative upbringing. Then he went to the universities and got all this modernistic, anti-biblical stuff, you know, Barton told me in a class I had told the whole class, he said he went to Harvard in order to be a second William Henry Green, defending the Pentateuch. But when he came out, he agreed with the higher Christian. Well, he just summarized the development of his thought and his context during the years that I'd have given anything for that talk. Montgomery thought it was terrible, a waste of time to hear him talk so long, but it was just the thing that would have interested me, of course. Yeah. Barton was not considered at all as a scholar of the depth of Montgomery, but he wrote a lot of books. And
what sort of courses did you take from him?
Let's see if I can remember now.
Were they in languages, or was it?
I remember there was a Negro minister, young fellow, who took courses there. And one day, 3 or 4 years later, I ran on to the station. I said, what are you doing these days? Oh, he says, reading the pastoral epistles with Dr. Barton. So I guess he gave courses in Greek and in other languages. He wrote on Babylonian and other things.
Now, who else did you study with there?
I think a little from Barton. A fair amount from Montgomery, but mostly from Spivey.
How was your interaction with the University Museum at that point? Were you
I took a course one time from Pfizer, in which we were told that he told me that they met in the university museum. The class met, was going to meet there, and so I went out to university to go to the first class, and I went to the front door of the museum, and I said to the doorman, I says, where does Dr. Spicer's class meet? Oh, he says, Dr. Spicer doesn't have any classes here. And I said, he said to me, this class here. Oh, he says, he must have meant the Oriental Seminar over at the in the library, he said. So I went over to the library there, and I studied and worked in the library in the seminar room. And then Dr. Spicer arrived. He says, you didn't come to class. I told him what happened. Oh, he said, we go in the back door. He says, well, I said, the doorman told me you didn't have any class in the university there. He says, if he'd know enough to know whether I had a class there or not, he wouldn't be a doorman.
So some of the classes were held over there in the museum.
No, I think they didn't. I think from then on they met in the seminar room.
So you had all of your classes in the Oriental Seminar Room,
yeah.
And in the old library then.
This was all in the old library.
Yeah. You know.
Which way was up on the fifth floor.
Was that torn down when Van Pelt was built, or?
No, they changed it into a fine arts building.
I see.
Yeah. Well, what's up? You got it on?
Well, there's one question I remember reading in the book that was dedicated to you, Interpretation of History, about this discovery of the city of Dan.
Oh, no. Yeah, that I was going to tell about. When we went on this trip, we got way over in the back country of Palestine, way over in Transjordan there, and we saw a hill there, which as we looked at, we could see a triple line of fortification. Now you see the rocks, you know, how it stood out from a distance right near, you might not even notice. And Dr. Albright was all excited. He says that he had found on the map a place there which had an Arabic name somewhat like the word Ham, which was in that location and would be sort of between two other places which are mentioned there in Genesis 14, called Zuzim's in Ham was one, but they mentioned two other groups that had been conquered by these kings from the east. And he said he had noticed there was a tell in that area and had advanced the theory that perhaps this was Ham. But then now when we got there where we could see the tell up there, in the distance you could see the line of fortifications of successive walls and tell that had been occupied during those periods in ancient times, though no excavation had yet been done there. In fact, it was only a name on the map that the map makers, you know, got from the Arabs, so the name of the village in the neighborhood. And it was written up in the New York Times about how our group discovered Ham. But see, as Albright said, the statement about the kings coming from the east, you know, that Abraham fought with, you know, it says they conquered these people and the Zuzims in Ham, and these other two places were known. Ham was not known. And Albright said the discovery of Ham and of a fortified city at the location, he said, supports the truth of this statement in Genesis, which many had doubted, that because this was so different from the way that conquering expeditions came, the routes that they came in times for which we have much evidence, they all come further west, you know, down the coast, but here that they came through this eastern section, east of the Jordan, that's what it says in Genesis, but many people had said that, of course, was an error in Genesis,
And so Albright was quite excited that here was evidence that supported the statement.
Huh.
Huh. So,
it's fascinating.
And did that stick, that point, was that ham?
Oh, sir. Well, you can't prove it unless you excavate.
But, I mean, it has continued to be recognized as...
I don't know, but I'm sure that the evidence was quite sufficient.
Hmm.
I'm sure there'd be no question.
And what was your second question?
And I was also wondering, did you have opportunity to discuss the modernist views with Albright and other issues?
No, I went there to learn, not to teach.
Well, thank you.
But
Greg.
Albright was a fascinating man. I don't care if you want to talk about bringing up children or what you want to talk about. He'd always be fascinating to listen to. I enjoyed every contact I had with him. And it's interesting that having been there with Albright, that gave me quite some prestige when I got back to Berlin. And then having studied in Berlin gave me some prestige at the University of Pennsylvania. Sometimes a pleasure. Advisor or someone would say this such and such. Well, of course, Dr. McCrae knows all about this. Or advise Mr. McCrae that Mr. McCrae knows all about this. He studied under Zeta in Berlin. So I got a lot of knowledge there, but I got more prestige than one knowledge I got deserved, probably.
Now, who were your main professors in Berlin?
Berlin were doctors, were Professor Kurt Zeta, S-E-T-H-E, of whom one of the advanced graduate students at Pennsylvania said, "Why, he's a Zeta. He's written so much, he must be 100 years old by this time." But I had a little work with him my first year. I had his course in Egyptian, also for beginners. The Egyptian grammar, also for beginners. So we went to the class, and he starts in and goes right through the Egyptian grammar. Unless you knew a lot about it, you could hardly follow it. I took notes, everything I could get, but I didn't know anything about Egyptian yet. And he took maybe 6 weeks of that. Then all the advanced students who had all been coming to those lectures, they all quit. And there was a group of maybe 15 or 20 of us, and he started right from the beginning then and explained to us the making of the characters and the different things about it. And I remember one day he referred to a certain word, and which at the moment slips my mind, but... he was reading a passage, and it was difficult to fit this word in as meaning Lord. It just didn't seem to fit. And I raised my hand. I said, "Professor Zeta, couldn't you translate that word all?" And he, very graciously, said, "He says I explained that one day." He says, "I guess probably you weren't there that day. That this word, when it follows the noun, can mean all. But when it precedes, it must mean Lord." See, which didn't seem to fit the context at all. But, of course, he doubtless had 100 other contexts in mind, you know. But he very graciously explained this to me. And he says, "Yes?" The fellow says, "Why couldn't you render that as all there?" He says, "Won't you ever learn anything? Won't you ever learn anything? Don't you ever pay attention?" Oh, he went over after him.
And in German, it must have sounded all the more to our ears.
The interesting one, though, was Weissner, Professor Weissner. He was a great Egyptologist, a great Assyriologist. Once I told him, my mind's going bad. I tell you that some other time. But the thing was with Meissner, when he taught the language, he just dwelt on this grammatical point, so you couldn't help getting them. You know, he just insisted on it, very definitely. He was a really good teacher, and he would say, "What is this form?" You say, "This is such and such and such and such and such and such." He'd say, "Absolutely correct, no doubt.
Ganz Christi, sehr gewiss. And then you come to another form. He asks somebody, what's this form? They say something. No, he says, it's not that. It is such and such and such and such. Absolutely right. Certain. No doubt. He was always saying it. Ganz Christi, sehr gewiss. That American fellow visited me that didn't know any German. I told him he'd enjoy hearing my story if he could not class and reading texts. You really learned it with him. But Zeta was very interesting, very interesting. Unfortunately, he died between my first year, between my second year and when I went back for summer 2 years later. I was sorry. It was very interesting.
And you were one of the few Americans, or were there quite a few? Were there at least mainly Germans in the class?
Mainly Germans, but there were also Americans.
And probably others? English and
Danish? They had an organization of foreign students in Berlin, which they had, they all had to. German wasn't the native language of any of them, but they all had to talk German together because no other language that they'd all understand, you know. I only went to one meeting, but then they elected me the arbitrator, being from America, the arbitrator.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
And so you had, who else did you have besides those two professors?
I began,
Zeta and Meissner.
I began Babylonian. What was the name of this fellow? There were eight of us. Began Babylonian, or they called it Akkadian there, and in America they used to call it Assyrian. Well, what we actually used was Assyrian texts of the Assyrian kings, and their official inscriptions. We started in. He lectured us 2 days on grammar, and then assigned 30 lines to read. And I would say, of a form, is this the third feminine singular permansive song? So he'd say, oh, that's right. As if he was kind of amused that I knew it. Before long, everybody dropped out of the class except a man who was studying the language. He had taken a course in 8 years before, and now he was freshening up on it for use in research in the history of medicine. And this man, this doctor, and I were all that were left of the eight, because the rest just all dropped out.
Unbelievable.
He was a nice fellow. He had visited the Princeton University and so on, but as a teacher. So I said, there's no use going on with that. So I found that I went to see Professor Meissner, and he wasn't giving a course, but what would be quite a bit more advanced. So he said, here's a man who is very good in this area, who's connected with the museum, and he says, if you could get some tutoring from him. See, there's 2 months between semesters. So I went to see Dr. Opitz, and he was very friendly, and of course we were very formal and studied together, and he was a good teacher, and I learned a lot and went ahead, so I skipped, you see, the semester. And he gave me a good training, and all his work was valuable. But then he began asking me to stay and have tea with him back after the. See, I went out to his home for the lessons, and he asked me to do that, and I became pretty friendly with him. And he even took me to some special meetings there and different things. And then the next year, when I was there, I wanted Dr. Opitz to give me some help. Says, I want to get all I could out of my work there. Oh, he says, I'm awful sorry, but he says, my time is just so full. He says, I have to, he says. Well, he was giving a Jewish fellow from Sweden that Opitz had no use for, whatever. He was giving him tutoring. But he says he just needed the money, so he had to do it. Well, I said, I'd gladly pay you for hours, like I had it first. Oh, but we're friends now. I couldn't charge you. So he couldn't charge me anything. But he couldn't afford to do it as a friend, and he couldn't charge because he was a friend. But he and I, we kept up for years together. Mm. I saw him at 47 when I was over there. It was 20 years later.
Mm.
But, let's see, who else did I take courses with? There was another man, an Egyptian named Switzino, I took a lot of lectures from. And, of course, there were a lot of American students there studying theology, studying New Testament. So they were getting around. Oh, yes, Salim. Professor Salim. He published an Introduction to the Old Testament, which went through many editions, and then after he died, others took it over. But they still put his name on it, and they kept new editions of it, you know. He was quite a famous scholar. He was conservative. He was so conservative that he believed that Moses wrote the Ten Commandments, but he reinterpreted them so they became such simple statements that could be made by the most primitive people. So, but once a student from Scotland who later became professor of Old Testament for years and wrote books in Scotland on Old Testament commentaries, he says, I knew he was conservative before I came here. He says, as if he was sort of listening, because he was so conservative. We had two sections in Deuteronomy, 60 people in each section. And, I could have looked at that Hebrew and given it right off in English. I could have looked at the English and given it right off in German. But to look at the Hebrew and give it direct in German, that was difficult.
Indeed.
That was really hard.
Couple quick questions. Who was this scholar from Scotland that felt Selene was conservative? Do you remember the name?
Now it is funny. In my mind, it's getting tired. It's not. I don't mean it's tired now. I mean it's tired in general. Names come back slowly. But it's interesting that I met two fellows there from Scotland. One of whom was in the class with me with Selene. The other of whom went as one of four of us who took hired a car and went up the coast and down across. This Damascus, different places. These two Scotchmen I met there, one of them became professor of Old Testament in Edinburgh and the other in Glasgow.
Mm.
And
so it's really the cream of biblical scholarship's up-and-coming generation.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Absolutely.
Now, the other quick question, and it's not really a quick question, some we may want to come back to.
Yeah.
You know, people have talked about Gresham Machen's struggles in Germany, and of course his faith was very much intact.
But
did you ever have any struggles like this? Obviously, you did not consider this Professor Salim to be conservative.
No.
What was your...
Lord blessed me with a skeptical mind.
Hmm.
A skeptical type of mind that I... that's one reason I was able to get through Occidental. Because they had to have professors with Harvard or Yale training, of course, and that meant they'd all been brainwashed. So I was skeptical of all their theories. I thought what I had been brought up in was just as good as anything they were doing. But when I graduated, I even said to somebody, I says, I don't have any definite convictions on anything, I says, and I don't expect to get any until I'm 50, and then I hope that I'll have sense enough not to get any. Some fool statement I made then, but it just shows you how they didn't, I did not accept anything they gave. I still believed exactly what I had before. But as I saw the faults and flaws in all they gave, but I was just like this. Then I went to the Bible Institute for a year. And got grounded in what I already believed, and of course.
And then at Princeton Seminary.
Princeton Health.
But didn't you feel any impact in Germany, as so many claim to have felt?
Oh, if you took those biblical courses, you couldn't help it. There was a man there that got the licentiate, which was the equivalent of PhD. He got the licentiate, and he had to put up 10 theses.
Like Stellung then, or something. Dr. Vinoy had to do that for his...
Yes, well, he had to... they didn't call him... I forget what they called him there, but one of his was that... it wasn't true to say that the Jews had stoned Moses to death. You know, that's what Freud said. Did you ever see Freud's book, Moses and Monotheism?
Just the title. I don't know anything about it.
He didn't publish it as long as he was in Austria because he thought it could hurt his standing there. But when he went to England, he published this book, Moses and Monotheism. And according to the book, there was this King Akhenaten who had his one god, the god of the physical sun, was the one god of the universe. And Akhenaten, who some have called the first individual in history, I think, this view, some Egyptian who held this view taught it to Moses. And Moses therefore believed in monotheism. And this is what, I think, did Salim, there it is. Anyway, that's what Freud said that he did, and that then in the wilderness, the Jews stoned Moses to death. And that established a thing in their mind, you know. There was a thing in the mind that came out a few generations later. The horror of having stoned their great father teacher. So the monotheism came out later, and that's how we got monotheism from the Jews. It all came from Akhenaten, but through this, that's Freud's crazy book, actually. But that's the few weeks. Well, this fellow, one of his theses was that it is not true that the Jews stoned Moses to death in the wilderness. And he had five or six, I thought, crazy views, and the Old Testament and New Testament professors there, they just made him look like a fool in the discussion. And then they gave him the degree. And this fellow from Scotland said to me, oh, he says, I felt so sorry for that fellow, the way they treated him. He says, I thought he ought to receive the degree after going through that. But I thought they made such a fool of him, he shouldn't have gotten the degree.
Well, you know, Dr. McCrae, you never shared the story about the shuffling the feet in the class that time.
With Harnack.